It's 9.5 minutes past 8 o'clock. Well, here's a quote from Thomas Rick's book, Fiasco. I want to start out with this. President George W. Bush's decision to invade Iraq in 2003 ultimately may come to be seen as one of the most profligate actions in the history of American foreign policy. The words of Thomas Ricks, Pulitzer Prize-winning military correspondent with The Washington Post and author of the book Fiasco, The American Military Adventure in Iraq. It's just been issued in paperback with some updates from the hardcover edition, and it's in bookstores now. Mr. Ricks joins us by telephone. Good morning. Thanks for being on the program today.
You're welcome.
The news just keeps getting worse and worse from Iraq. But your book, you deal with some of the things that went wrong really early on. Talk a little bit about that. What were some of the really big mistakes that happened early, and then after the initial military action was completed, what went wrong after that?
I'd say that the majority of the blame during the run-up to the war has to rest on the shoulders of the Bush administration. But I don't think people really get how much the military screwed it up after the fall of Baghdad. And I'd say the majority of blame for the botched occupation should rest on the shoulders of the generals rather than the politicians. Big mistakes during the run-up to the war. The very way in which we went to war, people don't seem to notice. The Bush administration went to war in a very exclusionary way. They confused questions with dissent, and they considered dissent to be disloyalty. So we went to war with probably the worst war plan in American history. It was a plan based on best-case assumptions, and it was an inflexible plan because it had no way of dealing with contrary information. They simply wouldn't listen to it. And most strikingly, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld and Army General Tommy Franks, the main writers of the plan, spent the majority of their time thinking about a relatively small problem. How do I get to Baghdad? And almost none of their time thinking about the 90% problem, what do I do once I get there? It's like somebody who thought that the most important part of the job was the commute and that all they had to do was get to work and put their feet up on the desk. Worse than that, General Franks got to Baghdad and then quit the U.S. military. He actually retired. It's as if General Eisenhower put Omar Bradley on the beaches of Normandy on D-Day, and then on June 7th, 1944, sent him a note saying, good luck on your way to Berlin. I'm going to retire and play golf. So this entire war is really an anomaly in U.S. history. It's very different from U.S. tradition. The way the Bush administration went to war is an aberration. The fact that we are waging a war while having tax cuts is extremely unusual. It's also the first ever American occupation of an Arab country. It's the first time we have fought a sustained ground war overseas with an all-volunteer force, and we are putting a huge strain on the U.S. military right now because of that. It really is an unusual oddity that I think, as you quoted, will go down as one of the biggest mistakes this country's ever made.
Well, it's almost, I don't know if this is ironic or not, but I look for irony everywhere, so maybe I see it in places where it isn't. But today is the anniversary of the Gulf of Tonkin resolution. Compare the current conflict in the Middle East with what happened in Vietnam in terms of how it was. That was a war that many now perceive to have been very badly mismanaged.
Yeah, it's funny, actually. One thing I've actually heard from people in the military is we did this better in Vietnam, which is a scary thought. There are parallels to the Vietnam War. But what strikes me is actually the differences. During the Vietnam War, there was massive demonstrations, 500,000 people showing up in the streets of Washington, D.C. Here, American unhappiness with the war has grown much more quickly. And it puzzles me that there is so much discontent with this war. The majority of Americans are very unhappy with it. Yet there's almost no public manifestation of that. And I think it may be precisely because the majority is against it. They know that everybody, you know, that they know is against it, which is very different from Vietnam. The big Vietnam demonstrations occurred when the majority of the people still supported it. And I think that's why we may not see this public standing out and sort of being counted against the war. I worry also that there's kind of a sense of despair when I'm out talking about my book with people. one of the things that comes up is people say, look, I've got it, I agree with you, but what can I do? I thought that I expressed in my vote last year my unhappiness with the war, but nothing's happening to change it. So I think people are feeling pretty frustrated but don't know quite what to do. I think the better analogy than Vietnam, though, is probably the French war in Algeria, the war against the Algerian independence in the 1950s. That's the war that I've gone back and read a lot about to understand what we're doing in Iraq.
The differences, too, between this war and the Vietnam War, there was a draft during the Vietnam War, and there were a lot more troops involved, and people were subject to the draft. I remember being in college at the time and standing in the college radio station at the UPI teletype machine waiting for the draft lottery numbers to come across to see where I would be. And fortunately for me, my number was 226, and I didn't end up having to go. But I had friends, lots of friends, who were drafted and went to Vietnam, and some of them didn't come back. One of the things that strikes me about this Iraq conflict is how little connection there is between the war and what's going on in this country, in terms of we don't have sacrifices like we had in World War II, where you had to there was rationing and so forth, because we're paying for this war with our credit card. There's no draft, and so it's a volunteer military, and so we don't have that to work against. It just seems that we aren't really there's this disconnect between what's happening in this country and the war itself.
That's a very good comment. I agree with it. This is essentially a 1% war. 1% of Americans, which is the military and their families, are involved in this war, and the other 99%, we're just driving our big SUVs around and hoping that the price of gas stays low. We have never really mobilized this country for what is supposedly, according to the Bush administration, the great struggle of our time. It strikes me, especially when I go to college campuses, the lack of interest in this war. There's a very small minority that's very interested in it and has a variety of opinions about it. But broadly, people in college campuses just don't seem to be paying a lot of attention. The one thing that does get their attention is when I thank them for picking up the tab for the war, because this war is being financed by borrowing, as you indicate, especially by Chinese purchases of U.S. government treasury bonds. And our generation is not going to pay that bill. They are going to pay it, and that gets their attention. Because we don't have a draft, it does seem to detach the society. You've always had soldiers coming back from war feeling alienated from the society that sent them. A great World War II movie about that is The Best Years of Our Lives. Also in Vietnam, people felt that. I'm sure it was true even during the time of Odysseus and the Odyssey and his alienation when he got home. The difference for our soldiers now is when they come home, they know they're going back in 12 months. Most draftees did one tour in Vietnam and then got out. Here you have guys in the military going back for third, fourth, and even fifth tours in Iraq, and it's really wearing them down. One of the differences you remind me as we talk about this from the Vietnam War, and I don't think this is sunk into people in this country, is Iraq almost certainly is going to be more of a problem for this country than Vietnam was. We could walk away from the Vietnam War. If you were Cambodian, it stunk. If you were a Vietnamese ally of the Americans, it stunk. But as a country, it was only 6 years for us between the fall of Saigon and the election of Ronald Reagan and people declaring it mourning in America. It's not going to be mourning in America for Iraq in 5 or 6 years. I think we're going to be dealing with this for another decade or two and may well have combat troops there for another 10 years.
We're talking with Tom Ricks, Pulitzer Prize-winning military correspondent with The Washington Post and author of the book Fiasco, The American Military Adventure in Iraq. It's just out in paperback with an update from the hardcover publication of this book in 2006. There's a front-page story on in the Washington Post this morning concerning some missing weapons. Apparently, weapons that the U.S. has purchased for the Iraqi authority. We're talking 190,000 different weapons that are missing. The situation, every day you open the paper or you turn on the television, and there seems to be some new goof up or something going wrong with this effort.
Iraq is a gift that just keeps on giving. You know, when you make mistakes, and especially when you make mistakes and then won't fess up to them and deal with them, they tend to get worse. And we've seen this again and again in Iraq. The official rush is to optimism, seizing on nuggets of good news and disregarding boulders of bad news. So right now, for example, one thing that really strikes me about Iraq is the south of Iraq is kind of falling apart, but nobody's really paying a lot of attention to it. The weapons thing struck me because I think while an insurgency was inevitable in Iraq, I don't think it was inevitable that you'd have fighting and resistance of this scope, duration, and intensity going on for 5 years. Remember, we have fought now in Iraq longer than this country fought in World War II, and we have a lot less to show for it. On the missing weapons specifically, this is just of a piece with the way we went into Iraq. Any insurgency, as it comes together, faces three basic issues or problems or hurdles: recruiting, arming, and financing. And the decisions we made early on in Iraq helped solve all three of those problems. We effectively recruited for the insurgency by dissolving the Iraqi military and by the way prisoners were treated in detention. The arming problem we solved for them because we didn't have enough troops to guard the big weapons caches, and we didn't blow them up because we falsely believed as a country that there might be weapons of mass destruction, chemical weapons, in those bunkers. And finally, financing occurred because we allowed them before the war to truck large amounts of cash and valuables and documents into Syria, where they began to run the insurgency. On those weapons, yes, almost certainly some of those weapons have wound up in the hand of the insurgents, but this is nothing new. I remember interviewing an intelligence guy who was trying to track down some weapons in the city of Ramadi that they saw the insurgents with, and they thought they were police weapons. Upon investigation, they learned, no, the police hadn't sold the weapons to the insurgents. They were renting them to them every night.
Oh, my goodness. We're going to take a short break, and then when we come back, we'll continue our discussion about the book Fiasco, The American Military Adventure in Iraq, and we'll take your calls at 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. In Madison, please use 263-1890. I'm John Munson, sitting in for Joy Cardine, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's just about 23 minutes past 8 o'clock. John Munson sitting in for Joy Cardine today on the Ideas Network and for the rest of this week, in fact. My guest is Thomas Ricks, Pulitzer Prize-winning military correspondent with the Washington Post, author of the book Fiasco, The American Military Adventure in Iraq. It's just come out in paperback with some updates from the first edition. And he's joining us by telephone. And you can join us by phone, too, at 800-642-1234 or 263-1890. You mentioned the south of Iraq. You've got a story on the front page of the Washington Post this morning that's talking about what's happened after the British pullout in southern Iraq. What's going on there?
Well, what's happened is the British have pulled way back from their original bases across the south, and now they're in one small base outside the city. And an American official in Iraq said to me the British essentially have been defeated in the south, down in Basra. That's significant for us because some people believe that Basra today is Baghdad next year, in which the U.S. is drawing down its troops, which will happen next year, and Iraqis are fighting among themselves for who's going to control the country. Basra is a big prize because it's where all the oil exports go through most of the time, and there's a lot of money there. The interesting thing is the fighting in Basra has nothing to do with al-Qaeda, which is not a presence down there, and has nothing to do with the Sunnis, who are not much of a presence down there. The fighting down there is between Shiites. And this is a little bit worrisome because there are some people, such as George McGovern, who have said all you need to do to really have peace in Iraq is get the U.S. out of there. And because we're the sand that irritates, you know, we're a foreign body that irritates them, and you can get peace by pulling out. Well, the evidence down south in Iraq is no, if you pull out, there will simply be more fighting in a variety of ways.
Let's take a call now. We'll go next to Paul in La Crosse. Paul, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Yes, good morning. About a week ago, O'Hanlon and somebody, another guy whose name I can't remember.
Ken Pollack.
Yes, who wrote a piece that was talking about how this is a war that we could win. Now, he disavowed the title as it appeared in the New York Times, but still, that's the take that everybody has had on it. It's diametrically opposed to the point of view that you have got. I was wondering, what kind of a tour did the American government give them in Iraq that led them to that conclusion? And if you could look at their argument for a moment and tell, you know, what did they get wrong?
Sure. I think, you know, they went in for, I think, about 8 days and saw mainly Sunni areas, which is a legitimate focus because that's where a lot of the fighting has been over the last 5 years. I think where their article went wrong is it treated the political situation in Iraq as an asterisk, which is, hey, their argument was, hey, things are really improving militarily, security's improving. Well, that's a purely tactical question. The strategic question, and remember that's always going to be determinative, the strategic question is, where are Iraqi politics going? And that undercuts everything else they said in that piece, because Iraqi politics are going backwards. Prime Minister Maliki is doing basically a Michael Jackson moonwalk. He looks like he's moving forward, but he's actually moving backward. Iraqi political reconciliation is not occurring. In fact, the Iraqi government right now is falling apart. And if you don't have an Iraqi government, military progress on the ground is relatively meaningless because it can't be sustained. If you look at the surge, the purpose of the surge, as announced by the president when he rolled it out back in January, was, and I'm almost quoting word for word here, was to create a political breathing space in which national political reconciliation can occur. And that is not happening at all. So they kind of treated that as a parenthetical midway through their article. In fact, it is the single most important fact mentioned in that article.
Thanks for the call, Paul. You mentioned you take great pains in your book to make a distinction between the leadership, both political and in the military, in this conflict from the United States perspective, and the troops on the ground and the things that they're having to go through. Talk a little bit about that.
Sure. 99% of U.S. troops are trying to do the right thing in 99% of the time and everywhere they are. I have a lot of respect for what the frontline troops have been through. It's a terrifically difficult mission, and we put these guys in a horrible situation, a strange land where they didn't speak the language, where the climate can be punishing in the summer, temperatures routinely of 130 degrees, where they an entirely alien culture to them, and we gave them an unachievable mission. Remember, the president sent American troops into Iraq with the purpose, the goal, of transforming Iraq into a democracy that then would be a beacon of change for the entire Middle East. An extremely large goal, probably the biggest goal this country has ever announced, bigger than the Marshall Plan. And we didn't give them the resources, they didn't have the troops, and they didn't have the leadership in their own military. The generals didn't understand the nature of the war in which they were engaged. A Secretary of Defense refused to recognize the existence of the insurgency at first. When the leadership is frozen at the top, is unable to understand the situation, unable to take on new information and make adjustments, it becomes very difficult to be successful, even if your troops are supremely good tactically, which they are. And so these guys have busted their hearts, but to very little effect over the last 5 years. I remember somebody joking that we're running the war in reverse. It's like a movie that begins with the ending, the fall of Baghdad, mission accomplished, and then here we are 5 years later fighting for Baghdad, still carrying out combat every day in that city, thinking that we had captured the city 5 years ago. So I don't even blame troops who have committed abuses. I think what they did was wrong. Was immoral, but you put a 19-year-old guy in a situation that he's not trained for, that he's poorly led by, and he's given an unachievable mission, and strange people are blowing up his buddies. Yeah, sometimes some guys are going to behave badly. They should be punished for what they do, but we should also recognize who put them in that situation, who didn't give them the training and equipment they needed. And the answer is all of us, but especially the generals and the political leaders who put them there.
Anybody who's read a Tom Clancy novel in the last 20 years probably came away from that with the belief that somehow or other the American military was invincible and that there was no situation that they couldn't take on and succeed in. Is that kind of a fair assessment of what we went into this conflict with, and where are we now on that?
I think that is a fair assessment, the sort of technological fantasy of the Tom Clancy novels, that any problem has a technological solution. What the U.S. military has come up against emphatically in Iraq is the fact that technology has its limits and that the human element not only is important but probably the determinative factor in war. And we were not equipped for that war. The most important space in the U.S. military is the space between soldiers' ears, and especially generals' ears. And there, they didn't have the concepts they needed to understand the war they were fighting. It's also significant because people who have not been in the military, I think, tend to overemphasize the strength of the military, the efficacy of the military, and the ability of the military to alter outcomes. And one of the things that you see at the top of the Bush administration is very little military experience, very little sense of what frontline combat really is. It's not precise. It's chaotic. It's difficult. It's bloody. It's confusing. And it's not really a way to achieve diplomatic and political outcomes.
Well, and these aren't set-piece battles. I mean, we're not sending this armored group with tanks and everything against another group that's similarly equipped. And so you've got all these tactics that were worked out in order to defeat the Soviet Union in Europe. And now we're in the desert. We're fighting an insurgency. There are roadside bombs, and you can't tell the civilians from the combatants. And it's nothing that we prepared for.
That's right. There's no front. There's no safe rear area. And the very environment is threatening. A dead dog on the side of the road might have a bomb in it, or a pile of garbage, or an empty box. So everything is threatening. And that really, by the way, increases post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, of this threatening environment. But no matter how good you are tactically, if you don't have a good strategy, it's meaningless. Tactics without strategy is like a Ferrari without a steering wheel. You'll go fast, but you probably won't go where you want to go, and you'll probably end up in the ditch. And for 4 years, that's essentially what the U.S. military was in Iraq, a fast car without the steering wheel of strategy. Now, with General Petraeus in there, I think we do have a strategy, but it took us longer than World War II to get there, and it's probably too little too late.
Let's go back to the phones and take a call from Earl in Milwaukee. Earl, good morning. Thanks for calling.
Now, with General Petraeus on there,
you'll have to turn your radio down, Earl.
But it took us.
There you go.
And it's probably too little too late.
Okay, I think Earl has not turned his radio down. So let's instead go to Dave in Wanakee. Dave, you're on the air. Good morning.
That was ironic, too little too late. Regarding General Petraeus, and while I think he is probably a very very effective military leader, I read his September report of how things are going in Iraq, and it said that while there are enormous problems up in front of us, there are a lot of reasons to be optimistic. For one, the Iraqi troops are taking much more of their share.
I think you're talking
there's
about
a lot of
this is the
op-ed
piece
on.
He wrote in September 2004, I think is what you're talking about.
Yeah, he wrote it in 2004.
Yeah.
So that makes me think David Petraeus is a cheerleader.
I think that's a bit harsh on Petraeus. He is a very effective military leader. He's very intelligent. He has a PhD from Princeton in international relations. But like a lot of people in the military, he's a can-do type guy. He tends to look at the bright side, partly because it's difficult to lead people, to be a commander, if you're a pessimist, if you think you're going to lose the battle. You want to go in looking at the bright side. And I think you'll see this in Petraeus when he comes back and testifies in front of Congress in 5 weeks. Essentially, I think he's going to be putting lipstick on a pig. That is, he's going to try to make a bad situation look somewhat better than it is. he'll say, don't pay attention to all those benchmarks we talked about last January. Let's look at these new trends that are more important, like the shift in allegiance from in some tribes and in Anbar province from being allied with the Al-Qaeda and Mesopotamia group to helping out the United States. And he'll also talk about the improvements he has made in security in parts of Baghdad. What he won't really dwell on, I think, is the fact that there's been no political progress in Iraq. In fact, there's been regression. And I think he'll end up by asking Congress to give him time. But I don't think he's really going to be able to portray it as a successful situation. At the same time, I don't think that it'll really change many opinions in Congress. He will try to get them to discuss the consequences of various courses of action. What would be the consequences of a complete pullout? Could you move to a policy of trying to contain Iraq? What would that mean? Or should you start thinking seriously about a partition of the country? How would that play out? All of those, by the way, have huge downsides that vastly outweigh their benefits. And the beginning of wisdom on Iraq, I think, is for us to understand there are no good answers left. All we have now is bad answers. And the question is, what is the least bad answer? The bottom line, I think, on Petraeus' testimony, though, will be I don't think Congress will pull the plug on the war. Why? Because I don't think the Democratic Party wants to get tagged with ending the war in Iraq like it got blamed for ending the war in Vietnam and wasn't trusted by many voters in America for a couple of decades after that. So I think you'll see a lot of sound and fury, but not much change in positions.
Well, and in fact, the Democrats really don't have enough of a majority, particularly in the Senate, to make anything happen in that regard anyway.
Well, yes, but there are 21 Republican senators who come up for re-election next year. And when you ask them what it's going to be like running with Iraq in the background, their faces tend to turn white. You've already had a few Democrats and Republicans bolt from the White House on Iraq. Senator Gordon Smith from Oregon comes to mind. Susan Collins and also Olympia Snowe of Maine are very unhappy with the war and have said so. I think you'll see a few more Republicans bolt, but even if, say, 15 Republicans split with the president, which would give the Democrats an effective veto-proof majority, I still don't think they're going to pull the plug and cut off financing.
We've got some people who've sent us email messages. I want to be sure to get to some of these. Here's an email from Brian. I submit that while on the surface the invasion and military occupation of Iraq may seem to be a complete debacle, and it was entirely based on lies and propaganda, that this is actually a tremendous success when the real motives are considered. Right now, the Iraqis are being pressured to transfer 75% of their oil wealth to international oil corporations. That is a success. The military contracts are a tremendous success for the well-connected war profiteers. The military bases will remain in Iraq for decades. The Israeli lobby is happy with the U.S. military presence, and control of Iraq's oil is assured to the interests who launched this war. While democracy, liberation, etc. were never the goals, the real goals are being achieved at a high cost to the U.S. taxpayer.
I have problems with that. I think it's quite cynical, and I like to be based in facts. Opinions are cheap. Facts are hard to come by. The fact of the matter is Israel was not a supporter of this war. Israel said all along, and was pretty clear about it, that it considered Iran to be a greater threat than Iraq. Iran is backing Hezbollah, which is attacking Israel out of Lebanon. Iraq was not. So I think it's fatuous and anti-Semitic to say that the Israel lobby somehow supported this invasion is simply not correct. Israel's view was that, and it was correct view, was that Saddam Hussein was a paper tiger, that he was contained, that U.S. military action from 1991 until 2003 had effectively kept him in the box, and he was no longer much of a player in the Middle East.
How has your book been received since it's come out? What sort of reaction have you had from people?
It's funny, when I first started writing it, people said, you're going to call it what? And actually some people tried to talk me out of using the title Fiasco. When it came out a year ago, the reaction was, well, that title is a bit sharp, a bit edgy, but okay, I'll read it. Now, as I knock around the country on book tour, I'm in San Francisco right now, the attitude is, well, duh, I always knew it was a fiasco. And my response is, well, where were you when I was starting to write this book a couple of years ago? That's not true in all parts of the country. I was in Dallas last week on book tour, and it struck me that speaking at the Petroleum Club one day, that the response of people, you know, very involved in the oil business and so on was, wow, this thing is really kind of a mess. And, you know, the Bush administration might not have really had a good handle on this. It turns out the media was more accurate in its coverage of Iraq over the last 4 years than the Bush administration was. Not a surprise to me, but a surprise to some people in Texas, apparently. A big surprise to me in the reaction to the book has been the response of the U.S. military. Almost every day I get emails from guys in Iraq, officers, thanking me for it. One guy was saying to me actually yesterday, a Marine, that he liked the book because while he'd had a vague sense in Iraq that things weren't going well, he didn't have an overall picture or a sense of what was happening at the highest levels of command. And he said it confirmed for him and filled in his sense of things not going well and explained why he felt that. A battalion commander wrote to me, thank you for finally saying publicly what we've all been saying privately. The nicest confirmation happened recently when the Army War College notified me. And the Army War College is where they send the colonels they think might be generals, sort of for their final level of military education. The Army War College notified me that they had put this book on their required reading list and were issuing copies of it to all incoming students this year.
Wow. Congratulations.
Thank you. I would actually surprise me. I thought that might happen eventually. I didn't think it would happen this quickly.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll get to some more phone calls and some emails. The phone number is to call 800-642-1234. That's a toll-free number. If you're in Madison, please use 263-1890. We're talking about the book, Fiasco, The American Military Adventure in Iraq, written by Tom Ricks, Pulitzer Prize-winning military correspondent with The Washington Post. I'm John Munson, sitting in for Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8:43. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson, sitting in for Joy Cardine. This week on the Ideas Network, in this hour, we're talking to Tom Ricks, Pulitzer Prize-winning military correspondent with The Washington Post, author of the book Fiasco, The American Military Adventure in Iraq. It's just come out in paperback with some updates from the hardcover version. According to the news this morning, there are five Iraqi leaders who are boycotting cabinet meetings. Just wondering, you know, every time you turn around, Prime Minister Maliki has just got more problems on his hands.
Yeah, things are falling apart. And when people talk about progress, it just sort of boggles me. Yes, there is some tactical progress on the ground, but it's really overshadowed by the lack of strategic progress. And in fact, it appears that the Iraqi government is falling apart. And my real worry here is the other Iraqi players out there, the people who are significant, are going to start changing. Ayatollah Sistani, who has been a really limiting factor on Shiite violence, is an old man, and he's going to die at some point, probably sooner rather than later. And Hakim, another Shiite leader, has cancer, so he's probably going to die. Well, who does that leave out there as players? It leaves on the stage Muqtadir al-Sadr, the radical Shiite cleric, is probably the biggest winner in post-Saddam Iraq. And effectively, we've empowered this guy. This is a guy who has had his militia fight U.S. troops twice, not only survived, but thrived, who is a backer of Hezbollah, the terrorist organization, and who mounted what may have been the largest public demonstration ever in support of Hezbollah. And this is the guy that we're going to wind up with in Iraq? That just stuns me. It doesn't strike me as a good use of our tax dollars.
Here's another email question. Can we really call it a war in Iraq? What percentage of U.S. forces are actually doing any fighting? What percentage is just driving around getting blown up?
That was true perhaps a year ago. I think it's less true now. One thing is that they realized, finally, that Humvees, these armored sort of jeeps they drive around in, were big kick-me signs. And so one of the things they've done, especially in Baghdad, is get the troops out of those trucks and have them on foot patrol. It's harder to bomb a squad that is spread out with 50 meters between them than it is to bomb four guys sitting in a Humvee. They start using snipers against them, but it's also harder for a sniper to know where all the troops are if they're on foot moving around than if they're in a couple of noisy trucks bouncing around, and you can hear the noise, especially at night. So I think we have changed tactics and improved them. The most important part of the so-called surge is not the relatively small increase in troops, about 30,000 additional troops over the last 7 months. The most important aspect of it is that Petraeus has moved U.S. troops off those big isolated bases and out into combat outposts that are actually out among the people. And this is rule one of how to fight this kind of war, and it definitely is a war. It is get out among the people. The purpose, the goal in this war is not to capture and kill the enemy as it is in conventional war. The goal in this war is to protect the people and so make the enemy irrelevant. And we finally have gotten to that point in the war. But as I said, it took us 4 years to get to base, you know, to ground zero, to where you're supposed to start in this, and to take the first right step. And by the time we did that, the U.S. military, the Bush administration, the U.S. government had frittered away a lot of patience among Iraqis and among Americans, and that's why it's probably too late.
Let's take another call. This time we'll go to Joe in Manitowoc. Joe, good morning. You're on the air.
Morning. I'd just like to question an alternate plan and strategy they could have done. Seems that instead of sending in contractors from the United States to rebuild the infrastructure after we destroyed it during the beginning of the war, if they had utilized the people on the ground, the Iraqi people, and had them do their jobs that they were already doing before, rebuild the infrastructure, like you said earlier, keep their military together, then these people would have jobs, they'd have something to live for rather than something to fight for. And if that's not, that wasn't one of the major mistakes that we had made.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right.
Is there any way that we can get back to that at all, or is it just too late at this point?
The problem with it is, at this point, Iraqi society is so divided, and people have such tangled allegiances that it's hard to have Iraqis on U.S. bases. Even if an Iraqi wants to be with you, supports your cause, insurgents have a way of forcing his hand. He might be very supportive. He might like the Americans, but he comes home one day and there's a note on his front door saying, "We have taken your wife, children, brothers, sister, mother, and father hostage. And unless you do X, like drive a truck onto the base with a bomb in it, you will never see any of them alive again." Iraqis have equities. They have to live there after we're gone. And so a lot of Iraqis cut deals that we think are wrong, but if you walk a mile in his shoes, might seem to make a lot of sense.
Thanks for the call, Joe. Let's go next to Jack in Oak Creek.
Good morning. Say, I wonder if your guest could comment on the combat effectiveness that we may or may not be achieving in training the Iraqi army. I spent 2 years in Vietnam, and I remember starting with Eisenhower, we tried to train the South Vietnamese army, which was a standing army at the time, for 12 years. And as soon as we started pulling out, we know about the debacle and how the Vietnamese army, South Vietnamese army, collapsed. Are we having any better success? Did we learn something from our training in Vietnam so we're not going to have another debacle about the level of competence of the Iraqi army to put down the insurgency and all these other violent groups?
That's a very good question, and thanks for your service to the country. There was no question that the Iraqi army has been trained and equipped. They are better trained and better equipped than other fighters in Iraq, insurgents or militiamen. Unfortunately, that's not the issue. The issue, and I think there may be a parallel here to Vietnam, the issue is motivation. A Sunni insurgent knows what he is fighting for. A member of Muqtadir al-Sadr's Maqdi army knows what he's fighting for. A soldier in the Iraqi army frequently
is only fighting for a paycheck or doesn't know what he's fighting for, doesn't know if the Iraqi army will exist next year or even if the Iraqi government will exist next year. And that's why even the military question of the state of the effectiveness of the Iraqi military, even that is essentially a political question. We're going to get the answer to this question, by the way, next spring. As U.S. troops start drawing down, and they have to because we don't have any replacement troops for them, at the Pentagon they say we're out of Schlitz. As the troop numbers start coming down, Iraqi army units and police units are going to have to hold the areas the U.S. forces cleared but have now left. And so we will know next spring, beginning next spring, whether they are up to the job. And nobody can know for sure whether they are.
So what happens if they can't?
Then insurgents will, and al-Qaeda in Mesopotamia will retake neighborhoods, will intimidate the people. Shiite ethnic cleansing will intensify. You'll see people pushed out of neighborhoods and even out of cities. Battle lines will be drawn for an intensified civil war, and U.S. troops may well stand by as a full-scale civil war breaks out.
Let's take another phone call, this time from Daryl in Delavan. Daryl, good morning. Thanks for calling.
Yes, good morning. Everyone's heard about the $10 or $12 billion in cash that was sent over to Iraq in pallets and lost. Now, I was driving home yesterday, and I was listening to the CBC, and they were discussing 190,000 AK-47s provided by the United States government to Iraq, purchased from the Eastern Bloc, for arming the army and the police that were training, have been lost. 190,000 AK-47s have been lost in Iraq. It's like putting gasoline on the fire, I think.
That's a good point. It is worrisome. There's always been huge leakage of weapons. We were talking about this earlier in the show. But what we have done, we may have done, is simply intensify the civil war next year. This is also of a piece with the switch in allegiance of some Sunni tribes from al-Qaeda to the United States. This is not done because they suddenly have woken up and said, oh, Uncle Sam is right. It's an arrangement of convenience. And the Shiite government in Baghdad worries that all we're doing is cutting deals with Sunnis who next year will be fighting the Shiite government. And so that's another aspect of pouring gasoline on the fire. Why is this significant? As one general said to me in Iraq in May, just because you invade a country stupidly doesn't mean you should leave it stupidly. He said, he was talking about my book, Fiasco. He said, read it, gut it, understand it, agree with it. The question is where you go now. And he said, you can have policies and strategies that intensify the damage done, or you can seek to mitigate some of the damage you've done, to leave the country in a way that at least lessens the chances of extreme violence. You're not going to eliminate the chances altogether. And so there are real concerns that some of the steps we're taking now appear good in the short term, but worsen the problem in the long term. A Shiite politician recently was talking about these deals that Americans are cutting, and he said a baby crocodile is cute, but you can't have you can't keep an adult crocodile in your house. And he worried that these militias that we're empowering are going to grow up to become grown-up crocodiles that attack his government.
Is there any real sense of Iraqi nationalism, or is the fact that this is a tribal culture, does that make that impossible?
It's an odd question, because Iraqis do talk about Iraq and their country and so on. And at first I sort of thought, oh, that's like Americans talking about America. But then you realize they're talking about their vision of Iraq, and frequently that is mutually exclusive with somebody else's vision of Iraq. So when Sunnis talk about Iraq, frequently what they mean is an Iraq run by the Sunnis. A Shiite guy will talk about it's our turn to run Iraq, and he doesn't really have much of a place except out in the gravel pits of the Western Desert to put the Sunnis. So while there does seem to be an appearance of Iraqi nationalism, it is certainly not the inclusive vision that we talk about when we talk about our own country.
Let's get another caller in here. Bob from Verona, you're up next. Bob, good morning. Thanks for calling.
Good morning. Mr. Ricks, I read your book, and it was excellent, and I would recommend people read a companion book that would go with it, The Sorrows of Empire by Chalmers Johnson. And in it, he says, he sort of makes 4 points. He said, first, we'll be in a state of perpetual war, which will lead to more terrorism against Americans. Second, he said, we're going to have a loss of democracy and constitutional rights as the presidency eclipses Congress and is transformed into a pentagonized presidency. And then he says, we've already, an already shredded principle of truthfulness will increasingly be replaced by a system of propaganda, disinformation, glorification of war. And then lastly, he says, there will be bankruptcy as we pour our economic resources into ever more grandiose military projects and shortchange the education, health, and safety of our citizens. And I guess what's bothered me more as we've gone along is if, quote, we win, the cost may be greater to us than if we would lose. And I guess I'm looking at the larger framework. Shouldn't we really question our whole approach to these adventures and our sense of empire?
I think we should, but I also think we should look at the American system. I think one of the big problems that's not really been recognized over the last 5 years is after 9/11, the American system didn't work very well. And I'm especially thinking here of Congress, which did not act as a co-equal branch of government, which deferred much too much to the presidency, to the executive, and which failed in its basic function of oversight. It conducted almost no hearings on the conduct of the war. I was talking earlier about how this war is an aberration from American history. One of the biggest aberrations is the collapse of congressional oversight, really not asking the basic questions that they are supposed to ask about, okay, what's your strategy? What sort of resources does that strategy require? Do we have those resources? Is that an intelligent and wise expenditure? How's this training and advisory program going, given that it's the key to our exit strategy? How much does the war cost? We're still working on estimates because the Pentagon wouldn't break out Iraq from Afghanistan. The cost of the war, by the way, is $3 billion a week. 3B with a boy, billion.
That's
a
lot
of money. And it might have been better spent, as you indicate, in other ways. If you want to fight a war on terror, maybe one way you might have done it was to give the Pakistani government 1 week of Iraq spending, $3 billion, which is a lot of money, and say, spend it on education. We really don't want to even question how you do it, but just spend it on education.
And we're going to have to leave it. We're going to have to leave it there because we're out of time. Thank you very much, Tom Ricks, for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
I'm John Munson, sitting in for Joy Cardi all this week on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.